Thank you, Sabra, and good afternoon, everyone. It's a great opportunity for me to address the National Press Club. Thank you very much for the invitation. And as you said, Sabra, the last governor to address the press club was Bernie Fraser back in 1996. So it's been a long time between drinks, and I'm very glad I'm here. The media and the RBA share a very special relationship. Most people in the community hear the RBA's messages through the media. You report on what we say, you filter it, sometimes better than others, and you critique what we say. But you also help us with we also help you with your work. The RBA is a reliable source of information and analysis on issues that your audiences care about: interest rates, housing prices, and jobs. And this means that we have a strong mutual interest in understanding one another, and I hope that today's address will help strengthen that understanding. This is my first public speech this year, so I'd like to talk about the year ahead and some of the key issues that the RBA will be focusing on. I'll first discuss the global economy, then I'll turn to the Australian economy, and I'll finish with some remarks about the outlook for monetary policy. At the outset, though, I want to emphasise that we don't have a crystal ball that allows us to see the future with certainty. I know many of you are looking for definitive answers to questions like, where will the cash rate be this time next year? How much will housing prices fall? And when will wages growth reach 3%? They're all really good questions. The reality, though, is the future's uncertain, and none of us can say with certainty what will happen. What the RBA can do, though, is to highlight the issues that are likely to shape the future, to explain how we're thinking about those issues, and to discuss how they fit into our decision-making framework. And that's what I hope to do today. I want to start with the global economy, because what happens overseas has a major bearing on what happens here in Australia. My main point here is that while some of the downside risks have increased over recent months, the central scenario is for the world economy to grow reasonably well over the next couple of years. It's worth recalling that 2018 was quite a good year for the global economy. Growth in the advanced economies was above trend in the first half of the year. Unemployment rates reached multi-decade lows. I think you can see this in this first chart. Inflation was low, and the financial systems were stable. These are pretty positive outcomes, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. There was, though, a change in momentum in the latter part of the year. The change is particularly evident in Europe, but it's also evident in China. It's been widely reported in the media, but it is important to keep things in perspective. Some slowing in the global economy was expected, given that labour markets are fairly tight, and some tightening in the US was desirable, given that they've had above trend growth over recent times. So I've been a little surprised at some of the reaction in the media to the lowering of the forecast for global growth. Some of that reaction has been quite negative. We need to remember that the IMF's central forecast is still for the global economy to expand by 3.5% in 2019 and 3.6% in 2020. As you can see in this chart, if achieved, these would be reasonable outcomes, and they wouldn't be too different from the recent past. What is of more concern, though, is the accumulation of downside risks. Many of these risks are related to political developments: the trade tensions between the US and China, the Brexit issue, the rise of populism, and the reduced support from the United States for the liberal order that has supported the international system. And one could add to this list the adjustments in China as the authorities rein in shadow financing. The origins of these diverse issues are complex, but in my view, there is a common economic element to many of them, and that is the extended period of little or no growth in real incomes for many people. In a number of countries, growth in real wages has been weak or negative for some years. Advances in technology and greater competition as a result of globalisation also mean that many people worry about their future and that of their children. Understandably, politicians around the world are responding to these concerns. Time will tell, though, whether the various responses will help or not. I suspect that some of these responses will not help. Over recent months, the accumulation of downside risks has been evident in business surveys and consumer surveys around the world. It was also evident in increased volatility in financial markets around the turn of the... I can't see whether I've gone too far here. It's also been evident in the increased volatility in financial markets around the turn of the year. There were quite substantial decline in equity prices and an increase in credit spreads. Since then, though, markets have been more settled and some of the earlier market movements have been reversed. It's worth noting that part of this reassessment has been on the back of a change in the outlook for US monetary policy, with the Federal Reserve no longer expected to increase interest rates in the United States. There's also been a noticeable fall in long-term government bond yields around the world. The adjustments in financial markets over the summer sometimes generated reporting that to me seemed overly excitable. I'd have to say I lost count of how many times I read the words crash, plunge, and dive. Yet there is a positive side to some of these adjustments which gets less reported on. For example, the risks associated with stretched valuations in the equity markets have lessened. So too have some concerns that very low credit spreads could lead to excessive build-up of risk. And risks in many emerging market economies have receded, helped by the lower global interest rates and lower oil prices. So it is really important we look at the whole picture. For Australia, what happens in China is particularly important. Growth there has clearly slowed. From a medium-term perspective, this too has a positive side, as it mainly reflects efforts by the authorities to rein in risky financial practices and high debt levels. But the slowing is probably faster than the government had hoped for, with the economy feeling the effects of the trade dispute with the United States and the squeezing of finance to the private sector. The authorities have responded by easing policy in some areas, but they are walking a very fine line between supporting the economy and addressing the debt problems. And there's also the question of how the economy responds to the policy easing that's taken place. More broadly, though, Australia cannot insulate itself completely from the global risks, but keeping our house in order can go a long way to help. Our floating exchange rate and the flexibility we have on monetary and fiscal policy provide us with a degree of insulation. So too does our flexible labour market. Ensuring that we have predictable and consistent economic policies, credible public institutions, and a reform agenda that supports a strong economy can also help in the uncertain world in which we live. I'd now like to turn to the outlook for the Australian economy. Much as is the case globally, the downside risks here have increased, although we still expect the Australian economy to grow at a reasonable pace over the next couple of years. Our economy is benefiting from strong growth in infrastructure investment and an upswing in other areas of private investment. The labour market's also strong, and many people are finding jobs. This year, we'll also benefit from an uplift in LNG exports. The lower exchange rate and a lift in commodity prices is also helping. But against this generally positive picture, the major domestic uncertainty is the strength of consumption and the housing market, and I'll talk about those issues in a moment. We will be releasing a full updated set of forecasts on Friday in the Statement on Monetary Policy. Close readers of that document will notice that we will now be publishing forecasts for a wider set of variables than we have in the past, and we hope that will help people understand the forces shaping our economy. Today, though, I can give you a summary of the key numbers. Our central forecast is for the Australian economy to expand by around 3% this year and 2.75% next year. You can see that in this chart. For 2018, the outcome is now expected to be a bit below 3%. Growth rates of this magnitude should be sufficient to help see further progress in lowering unemployment. These forecasts are, though, lower than the ones we published 3 months ago. For 2018, the outcome is affected by the surprisingly weak GDP number in the September quarter and the ABS's downward revisions to growth in the previous quarters. We're expecting a better outcome in the December quarter, with other indicators of economic activity suggesting a stronger picture than the September quarter national accounts. For 2019 and 20, the forecasts have been revised lower by around a quarter of a percentage point, largely reflecting the downgrades to our outlooks for both household consumption and residential construction. The outlook for the labour market, though, remains pretty positive, and that's good news. As you can see in this chart, the unemployment rate currently stands at around 5%. That's the lowest in over 7 years. In New South Wales and Victoria, the unemployment rate's around 4.25%. You have to go back to the early 1970s to see sustainably lower unemployment rates in New South Wales and Victoria than we currently have. This is a significant achievement. The forward-looking indicators of the labour market are also positive. The number of job vacancies that firms say they have is at a record high, and firms' hiring intentions are very strong. Our central scenario is that growth will be sufficient to see a further modest decline in the unemployment rate to around 4.75% over the next couple of years. The other important element of the labour market is how fast wages are growing. For some time, we have been expecting wage growth to pick up, but to do so only gradually. The latest data are consistent with this, and a turning point is now evident in the wage price index, and you can see that here. In our discussions with business, we are also hearing more reports of firms finding it difficult to find workers with the necessary skills. In time, this should lead to faster wage increases, and in my view, this would be a positive development. Given this outlook, we continue to expect a gradual pickup in underlying inflation as spare capacity in the economy diminishes. However, the lower forecast for growth means that the expected pickup in inflation is likely to occur a bit later than we previously thought. Underlying inflation is now expected to increase to around 2% later this year and to reach 2.25% at the end of 2020. And the latest CPI data were consistent with that outlook. The headline CPI number was, however, a bit lower than had previously been expected, largely reflecting the large decline in petrol prices that's taken place. And we expect headline inflation to fall further this year as the full effects of the decline in petrol prices show up in the figures. So that's a summary of our key numbers. As always, there are a range of uncertainties, many of which will be discussed in Friday's document. Today, though, I would like to focus on the outlook for household spending, which is closely linked to the housing market and the prospects for growth in household incomes. Before I do that, though, I'd like to touch on one related uncertainty that we've been paying close attention to over recent times, and that's the supply of credit. This is because a strong economy requires access to finance on reasonable terms. Over recent times, there has been a needed tightening of credit standards in Australia. But the right balance does need to be struck. As lenders have sought to find that right balance, we have had some concerns that the pendulum may have swung too far the other way, especially for small businesses in Australia. In that context, I welcome the report of the Royal Commission and the government's response. The Commission's recommendations that bear on credit provision are balanced and they're sensible, and they should help remove some of the uncertainty. I also welcome the Commission's focus on the importance of service as opposed to sales in the financial sector, the necessity of dealing properly with conflicts of interest issues, and the importance of accountability when things go wrong. These are all issues that I've spoken about on previous occasions, and addressing them is central to rebuilding the all-important trust in our financial system. And I'm confident that the Royal Commission's report will help with that process. But back to household consumption and the housing market. You might recall that 18 months ago, the most talked about issue in the country was the high and rising cost of housing. It was understandable why people were talking about this. In some of our cities, purchasing a home had become a very difficult stretch for many people, and this rightly had become a major social issue. Today, the talk is about prices falling in our two larger cities. We seem to have moved almost seamlessly from worrying that prices are going up and we're too high, that they're going down. There's no single reason for this change, but rather it's the result of a number of factors coming together. One is that housing prices simply increased to the point in Sydney and Melbourne where demand tailed off, as purchasing a home had become more expensive and had become a less attractive investment option for many people. A second factor is that the building boom over recent times has significantly increased the supply of housing. It took a number of years before the rate of home construction picked up in response to faster population growth, but eventually it did pick up, and that's affecting prices. And in my view, this explains much of the cycle. A third factor is that demand for overseas investors softened, partly in response to the Chinese authorities making it more difficult to move money out of China. And a fourth factor is that lending standards have been tightened and credit has become more difficult to access for some people. Importantly, though, unlike most other housing price corrections, this one has not been associated with rising unemployment or been associated with higher interest rates. Instead, structural factors relating to underlying supply and demand in the markets in our two larger cities are at work. The question we're grappling with is what effect this change will have on household spending. And here my earlier observation about not having a crystal ball is relevant. At this point, though, what we are seeing looks to be a manageable adjustment in the housing markets in Sydney and Melbourne. This adjustment is not expected to derail economic growth. The previous trends in debt and housing prices were becoming unsustainable, and some correction was appropriate and inevitable. We recognise that this correction will have an effect on parts of our economy. But our economy should be able to handle this, and it will put the housing market on more sustainable footings. There are a few considerations here that I want to draw your attention to. The first is that the recent price declines follow very large increases in prices, as I think you can see in this chart. Even after the declines in Sydney over the past 18 months, prices are still up 75% on the level of a decade ago. And in Melbourne, they're up 70%. While the price declines are no doubt difficult for some people, there are many others who are sitting on very significant capital gains, and there are others who will now find it easier to buy a home than they had before. It's also important to remember that in a number of cities and much of regional Australia, things have been much more stable. We haven't seen the same cycles. A second consideration I want to draw your attention to is that most households do not change their consumption in response to short-term changes in their wealth. Sensibly, most of us take a longer-term perspective. During the recent upswing in housing prices, the strategy of borrowing against the extra equity in your home to finance consumption looked less sensible to many people than it had in previous decades. And some homeowners also see themselves as being part of the bank of mum and dad. And this means that they're reluctant to spend the extra equity in their home because they want to save some of that so that they can help their children purchase a property at some point in the future. I think that's an important consideration. A third and perhaps the most important consideration is that household income growth is expected to pick up, and that income growth usually matters more for consumption than short-term changes in wealth. For some years, growth in nominal aggregate household income has been unusually low, averaging just 2.75% a year since 2016. This is linked to the issue of weak wage growth that I talked about before. For some homeowners, rising housing prices have provided an offset to weak income growth, even though this effect might have been smaller than it has been in the past. And given this, aggregate consumption has grown faster than income over the past few years. But a shift is now taking place. Over the next year, we're expecting a pickup in household income growth to take place, and that will provide a counterweight to the wealth effects of lower housing prices. And labour market outcomes are really key to this assessment. Continued employment growth and higher wage growth should boost household disposable income. The announced tax cuts should also help here. In our central scenario, consumption is expected to grow by around 2.75% over the next couple of years, and that's broadly in line with household income. And this is lower than our earlier forecast for consumption. There are, of course, other possibilities as well. Continued low income growth, together with falling housing prices, would be a welcome combination, and it would make for a softer outlook for our economy. Some Australian households have a lot of debt, and there is a degree of uncertainty about how they would respond to this particular combination of low income growth and falling housing prices. So we're continuing to monitor things very carefully. The adjustment in the housing market is also affecting the economy through residential construction activity and the spending that occurs when people move homes. Residential construction activity is currently around its peak level, and the large pipeline of approved projects is expected to support activity for a while yet. Developers, though, are finding it more difficult to sell apartments off the plan, and lenders are less willing to provide finance than they previously were. And sales of new detached housing have also declined. The central forecast is for dwelling investment to decline by around 10% in the next 2 years. Putting all this together, our economy is going through an adjustment following the turn in the housing market in our two largest cities. It's important, though, that we keep this adjustment in perspective. The correction in the housing market follows an extended period of strength. It's largely due to structural factors, and it's occurring against the backdrop of a robust economy and an expected pickup in household income growth. Our financial institutions are also in a strong position to deal with the adjustment. Indeed, lending standards were tightened as the upswing in the housing market took place. So from this perspective, the adjustment in the housing market is manageable for both the financial system and for our economy. This adjustment will also help increase the affordability of housing for many people. Notwithstanding this assessment, though, given the uncertainties, we are paying very close attention to how things evolve. So this brings me to monetary policy. The cash rate has been steady at 1.5% since August 2016, and this stimulatory setting has helped our economy. The Reserve Bank Board has sought to be a source of stability and confidence while our economy adjusted to the end of the mining investment boom and responded to the shifting sands in the global economy. Over the past couple of years, economic conditions have been moving in the right direction. The labour market strengthened, the unemployment rate has fallen a bit more than we expected, and we expect a further decline to take place. Inflation is also above its earlier trough, although it hasn't changed much over the past year. Our expectation has been, and continues to be, that the tighter labour market and the reduced spare capacity in our economy will see underlying inflation rise further towards the midpoint of the target range. Given this, we have maintained a steady setting of monetary policy while the labour market strengthens and inflation gradually picks up. Looking forward, there are scenarios where the next move in the cash rate is up, and there are other scenarios where it's down. Over the past year, the next move is up scenarios were more likely than the next move is down scenarios. Today, the probabilities appear to be more evenly balanced. We'll be monitoring developments in the labour market particularly closely. If Australians are finding jobs and their wages are rising more quickly, it's reasonable to expect that inflation will gradually lift and that it will be appropriate to lift interest rates at some point. On the other hand, it is possible that the economy is softer than we expect and that income and consumption growth disappoint. in the event of a sustained increase in the unemployment rate and a lack of further progress towards the inflation objective, lower interest rates might be appropriate at some point. And we have the flexibility to do this if needed. So the board will continue to assess the outlook carefully. It does not see a strong case for a near-term change in the cash rate. We are in the position of being able to maintain the current stimulatory policy setting while we assess the shifts in the global economy and the strength of household spending. It's long been the board's approach to avoid reacting to high-frequency news. Instead, we have sought to keep an eye on the medium term and to put in place a setting of monetary policy that helps deliver on our objectives of full employment, an inflation rate that averages 2 to 3% over time, and financial stability. And I'm confident we'll continue to do that. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you very much for your speech there, Governor. A lot to take in there. I'd just like to go back to the Banking Royal Commission final report. But I also like you to look back in your rear vision mirror, if you would. Why do you think it is that the major banks lost their way, that, as the Commissioner points out, that greed at some point became a focus for many individuals and the culture within those banks changed? Why do you think that happened? And do you think the banks understand now that they've got to win back the trust of the Australian people?
Well, I think they clearly understand that. Why did this happen? I think there was a very clear focus on sales rather than service. I mean, at the end of the day, finance is about providing services to people, but many financial institutions had focused on selling product rather than sales. Why that occurred, it's hard for me to say. I think partly due to the internal remuneration incentives within financial institutions. I think another thing that happened was that the financial institutions were very profitable for decades. And when you're very profitable, you probably don't do as much introspection as you probably should. I think in countries where they've had banking crises, there have been more fundamental reviews of the way banking is done. In Australia, our banks, thankfully, have been profitable for decades. But it's likely that that generated a sense of hubris. They focused on selling product rather than delivering services. And I think they understand that now. And the Royal Commission's recommendations, I think, are sensible. They're balanced. They're needed reform. It's not revolution, which we didn't need. We needed kind of sensible, needed, pragmatic reform. And that's what we've got. And I really hope and expect that the banks learn the lessons.
Thank you. Our first question from the floor is from Peter Hatcher.
Thanks for your address today, Mr. Lowe. We're coming into federal budget season and federal election season. I'm sure you've noticed. The budget revenue has been boosted by an increase in commodity prices. With a view to your comment that Australia should keep an eye to keeping its house or putting its house in order, would you be happier? Would you think it a better national outcome if all of the increase, the temporary increase in commodity prices, were in fact banked as a surplus? Or on the other hand, with the softening in outlook that you've sketched today, would you be happy if the government threw caution to the wind and spent with its ears pinned back?
Well, it won't surprise you, I would not support throwing caution to the wind. I'm a cautious central banker. The announced tax cuts so far are going to boost household income growth later this year and next year, and I think that's a positive development in the world we're in. How much extra tax revenue there'll be from the higher commodity prices, it's hard to tell. My perspective, though, is really a medium-term one. We do need the budget to be returned to balance over time. I think it's important because one day we will have a downturn and we will want a fiscal response. And the lesson from the financial crisis globally was that the countries that did not have their fiscal house in order could not do a fiscal response, and they actually had to tighten fiscal policy at a time they needed to loosen it. In Australia, we didn't find ourselves in that position because of the good record on fiscal policy. So I think it's really important that we're in a position to be able to respond in the case the economy does have the downturn in the future, which, you know, at some point we will, and getting the budget back to balance on a reasonable timescale is part of that. So that's not throwing caution to wind. That's building, and I'm a strong believer in insurance and building buffers in the system. The Australian system has a lot of buffers. We have it with monetary policy, the exchange rate, I think fiscal policy. We need to have a strong buffer there as well, and getting the budget back to balance will be part of that.
Aaron Patrick.
Hi, thanks for a fascinating speech, Dr. Lowe. Just in relation to the Royal Commission, could it be the case that some of the leaders of the industry who were subject to adverse comments by Commissioner Hain should take personal responsibility for what's happened on their watch? And a couple of years ago, the RBA produced a chart showing that Australian banks were the most profitable in the world. Are they too profitable?
Should the leaders take responsibility? Of course they should take responsibility. What that means in terms of the jobs, I'll let others speculate on that. But, you know, cultural change really starts at the top in organisations. And so the leaders of organisations really need to be focused on delivering the right culture. And it's something that the Reserve Bank, we talk a lot about as well. So there has to be accountability, and you know, it starts at the top. So the second part of the question was, are banks too profitable? The return on equity in Australian banking before the financial crisis was similar to what we saw in Canada and some other Anglo countries. It was high, but it was not unique. It's still similar to the return on equity in the Canadian banks. At the moment, the Australian banks are earning roughly 13% return on equity. When I talk to overseas bankers and I ask them what return of equity they're targeting, and a number around 10 is common. So the Australian banks still have higher returns on equity than many international banks. I don't know how long that's sustainable, whether extra competition in the system will drive that over time, or maybe they've just got low credit losses at the moment and so they've got higher returns on equity. But it is a good question to ask or to contemplate why it is that the Australian banks can earn, on average, higher rates of return on equity than similar banks overseas. I'm not sure I have the answer to that.
The National Press Club's Financial Journalist of the Year, Peter Ryan.
Thank you. Mr. Lowe, thanks for being here today. About a decade ago, your predecessor, Glenn Stevens, surprised a lot of us by turning up on the Sunrise program one morning to warn people that real estate prices wouldn't always go up. So 10 years down the track, we've seen what's happened. I was wondering if you could say a few things about the psychology of consumers and investors, and whether to paraphrase Paul Keating, this is the correction that we had to have.
Well, Peter, let me first add my voice to those congratulating you on your award. It's fantastic to see you put together a great portfolio of work there. Is it the correction we had to have? I wouldn't put it like that. It was the correction that I think became inevitable. You think about what's really happened in the Sydney and Melbourne markets. Population growth in the mid-2000s picked up very substantially in both those cities. Sydney's a fantastic place to live, as Melbourne people, and there were plenty of jobs there, and people came there and lived there and really enjoy it. But the rate of home building did not pick up for almost a decade. It's staggering, really. The supply restrictions were so tight that the number of houses that we're building did not pick up in response to faster population growth. What happens when there's faster population growth and the number of dwellings doesn't increase at a faster rate? Prices go up. And then prices started going up, and investors thought this is a fantastic time to buy a house or an apartment. Prices are rising, and interest rates were low, and they could look forward to capital gains. So the psychology was really important. And I think things went too far, and inevitably there has to be some correction. The prices are declining as the extra supply comes into the market. And now the psychology has turned the other way, and people worry that prices keep falling. So the psychology is really important. I wouldn't say it was the correction we had to have, but I think it was the correction that was inevitable. As I said in my remarks, a year and a half ago, the most talked about issue in the newspapers and on radio and was high housing prices. You might remember that the budget a year and a half ago or 2 years ago was framed around reducing kind of the housing costs for many people. So that was a big national issue, and if we continued on that path, we were going to have huge problems. So, the other point I wanted to re-emphasise is that I think this is a manageable correction. It's not being driven by higher unemployment or higher interest rates. It's being driven by an increase in supply in response, or a lagged increase in supply in response to faster population growth.
Peter Switzer.
Thanks very much. As I'm on the Your Money channel with Money Talks, and your predecessor went on Channel 7 Sunrise, I'm inviting you to my show anytime you like.
You've got nothing
to do. Come along. I've gone long supporting the Reserve Bank on both growth and house prices. It's gotten me in a lot of trouble on Twitter. I'm being trolled all the day. A lot of bush economists on Twitter think you guys don't know anything about house prices, and I'm still supporting you, but it's taking me a lot of... I'm copying a lot of grief, Mr. Lowe. So I want to know, have I backed the right horse in going with the Reserve Bank? And secondly, how confident are you about your house price forecasting model?
Well, I wouldn't give up faith in the Reserve Bank. How confident are we about our forecasting model? Not particularly, because we have a range of models, and it's very hard to model housing price changes, particularly when the supply and demand factors have moved so much and the psychology is so important. I think it's likely that we'll see further price declines in Sydney. The rental vacancy rate's rising and rent growth is low, and there's significant supply still to come onto the market. Our price has got to very, very high levels, and so some further adjustment would not surprise me, but I think it's manageable. Some correction is entirely manageable, and it won't derail the economy. So don't lose faith.
Michael Rodham.
Thanks for the speech, Mr. Lowe, and apologies about so many crashes and plunges, but it's a better word than adjustment.
That's right. I understand adjustment won't sell stuff.
The RBA has been concerned about borrower quality and lending standards for quite some time. Given ASIC has found broker-originated loans of slightly lower quality than the banks, should trailing commissions be banned as proposed? And just one other quick one. Aaron Patrick alluded to it before. Hayne doesn't think that NAB has the right leadership to restore trust in the bank itself, and banking's about trust. I'm going to ask the same question, but a bit more directed. Should they go?
I'm not going to comment on that. It's a matter for the individuals on the board, and I don't think it's going to help things by me adding my opinion into the mix. In terms of the Royal Commission's recommendation on brokers, I agree very strongly with the idea that they should have a best interest obligation. I also agree very strongly that they're essentially providers of financial advice, and so they should be subject to the same regime. How the payments for the brokers work is a more complicated issue. In principle, I agree with trailing commissions being banned and the payments being up front. I think the government is right to be cautious about going the full way and making the borrower pay. The Productivity Commission has written extensively about this. There are legitimate competition issues. I think it's worth take the time to go through that, work through those competition issues. I know the government has asked, I think, the Council of Financial Regulators to look at the possibilities over the next few years. So I think on who actually pays, it's right to be cautious. But on those other two things, I think they're critical.
Tom Ray.
Thanks for your time today. Do you agree with the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development that the nation's housing market downturn represents the greatest threat to the economy? Or do you think external factors like trade tensions in China pose a bigger risk?
I think right on top of the list would be the global developments. And if we're to have a significant downturn in the economy, I think the catalyst would be something going wrong in the global economy. So that would be number one, and China would be at the top of that list. If the Chinese economy stumbled, the authorities didn't manage the the tightening up in credit world and the Chinese economy slowed, I think that would hurt us a lot. Of the domestic sources of risk, the housing market, consumption nexus is the most prominent one. But I wouldn't say that's more prominent than the overseas risks.
Ross Greenwood.
Ross Greenwood from the Nine Network. Can I just say welcome to Australia's media fraternity, and I trust that this will be a wonderful precedent for you to take a leaf out of your peers at the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and hold a media conference after each of your monetary policy decisions as they do. That would be a wonderful advancement on media and communications from the Reserve Bank. That's my observation. Okay. I trust you will take that. The second thing I'd like to ask you is you set out a set of conditions there under which the Reserve Bank might cut interest rates, loosen monetary policy. Does it trouble you at all that if those events did transpire, that even the cuts that you could bring to bear at that time would have almost no impact on the Australian economy or to improve its economic growth? Does it also trouble you that you almost, by having left interest rates unchanged for 30 months, have almost left monetary policy to the whim of the banks who have been so heavily criticised by the Royal Commission?
Can I comment on your comment?
Yes.
We've thought about kind of press conferences, but my judgment at the moment is the community hears enough from the Reserve Bank. I have a statement every month. I give at least one speech every month, sometimes two. My colleague gives speeches. We have the statement of monetary policy, the Financial Stability Review, various reports. So you get to hear a lot from us. And I worry that you might we might outwear our welcome if we kind of had another 11 appearances a year. In terms of the effectiveness of further interest rates cuts if we needed to do that, I'm confident that lower interest rates would stimulate the economy if that was what was needed, primarily through two channels. One is what we call the cash flow channel, because Australian households have net debt obligations, and so lower interest rates give them more money in their bank accounts each week, and they would spend some of that, and that would help stimulate the economy. The other channel is through a lower exchange rate. If we were to lower interest rates, I'm sure there would be an exchange rate response, and that would change the outlook in the trade sector. So primarily through the cash flow effect and lower exchange rate, that would stimulate the economy if that was what was needed. I am not concerned that having left the cash rate for so long at the current level, we've left monetary policy to the banks. You know, your media organisations report extensively when banks increase their standard variable mortgage rates. What they don't report on as much is that each day the banks are increasing the discounts on the standard variable rates. So the average rate that people actually pay on their mortgages has only moved a few basis points since the banks increased their standard variable rates, because a lot of people have switched to lower rate products. Many people, and I encourage everyone to do this, knocked on the door of their bank and said, "Can you give me a better rate?" And often the bank will say yes, otherwise I'll move. And the discounts that the banks are giving off their standard variable rates have increased as well. So the average rate that people paid has not moved very much at all. I think monetary policy is still the main determinant of mortgage rates in Australia.
Why don't you think Australians are curious enough to ring around and find out who is offering the best deal?
I don't know. I mean, it's a pain having to do it, isn't it? It takes time. We've all got other things to do with our lives than to kind of call up the bank and say, "Please give me a better deal." Even though I encourage everyone to do it, because the experience of most people when they do it is actually get a better deal. At the moment, the banks actually want to lend. And if you're a good quality borrower and you've had your loan for a few years and you're paying a higher interest rate and you're paying higher than the average, go and ask. I think the main thing that Australians can do to increase competition in the banking sector is demand of their banks better deal. Go and knock on their door, ring up, get online, go and ask for a better deal. We collectively, the 25 million people who are lucky enough to live here, can actually make a difference, kind of bank competition. And so sometimes I'm a bit frustrated at the comments that people say the banks don't compete, and partly it's because we don't make them. So we, the 25 million of us, can make them compete. And why we don't do it, I don't know.
And say that Phil sent you.
Yeah, that's
Quentin Dempster.
Quentin Dempster from the New Daily. Dr. Lowe, thanks very much for your address.
My question's about wage growth. Average real after-tax wages have been going backwards for 6 years. Greater Sydney's unemployment rate now starts with a 3, but still real take-home pay is going backwards. How low do you suspect unemployment will have to be before the labour market starts delivering real wage rises? Now, you put up the wage price index yep. graph, which and seemed to indicate that this is starting already, to what extent, what will it deliver in real wage growth, and is any further intervention necessary, for example, by changing laws to give employees more leverage?
I don't think further intervention is necessary. Our strategy has really been twofold. One is to keep interest rates fairly low, have the economy grow reasonably well, the labour market tighten up, and as it tightens up, firms compete more for workers and wages start moving. And that part of the strategy, I think, is actually working. The other part of my strategy has been to talk publicly about the benefits of stronger wage growth. For a central bank governor of previous generations, it's kind of almost unheard of thing to do because most of the time they were talking about the need for wage growth to moderate. So I've been trying to lift wage expectations, and I think that's gradually working, and to keep the labour market fairly tight. And in New South Wales or Sydney, the unemployment rate's 4.25%, and in parts of Sydney it's kind of 3 or maybe 2. And we do hear through our liaison program more stories of firms slightly increasing the wage increases. And I think that's going to continue. It's an interesting issue why we find ourselves in this situation. And up until this year, whenever I'd go to Basel, which I do 6 times a year to talk to the governors of the other central banks, it was the most commonly discussed issue, why in tight labour markets wage growth isn't picking up. So what's happening in Australia is really a global story. And my take is that the main explanation is that people feel like there's more competition and they're more uncertain about the future. And one of the things you learned I learned in first year economics was when there's more competition, prices are lower. And there's more competition because people are worried about competition from technology and competition from globalisation. So we all feel at some level in our heart that there's more competition out there. And at the same time, we're feeling more uncertain because of globalisation and technology. And when you're feeling there's more competition and you're more uncertain, you're less inclined as a business to agree to larger wage rises. And as a worker, you've got your job, you're less inclined to ask for a bigger wage increase. But at some point, I haven't given up on the idea that as the labour market tightens and firms start competing more aggressively for workers, wages will move. And the recent data are consistent with that assessment. I think we've just got to give it time, be patient. I think it's working.
Philip Lasker.
Hi, Dr. Lowe. Phil Lasker from ABC TV. There's been a lot of commentary following the Royal Commission's final report that it was a fairly soft result, a good result for the banks. A lot of people are sceptical that there will be cultural change. There might be some changes in the short term, but in the long run, banks will get back to their old way of doing things. But also in the report, the commissioner said that the regulators were too soft and they'd have to become more litigious. Do you think that in order to achieve real cultural change, in order for the banks to take things seriously, that the regulators will have to take people to court, will have to press criminal charges, and at least have some examples out there of tough action? And the other thing is, some people would say that the regulators might have been responsible for fueling the asset price boom by letting banks get away with too much. What about the favourable tax laws that are in place? To what extent do you think the favourable tax laws have been responsible for fueling an unsustainable asset boom and need to be changed?
There are a lot of questions embedded there. Do the regulators need to punish bad behaviour? And the answer to that is yes. And I think kind of a more aggressive approach by ASIC is called for. Part of the, or one of the central findings of the Royal Commissioner, is that it needs to be accountability when things go wrong. And in some cases, prosecution through the legal process is part of that accountability. But I want to emphasise the point that I think we didn't find ourselves in this position because of bad regulators. Now, Australia has, by international standards, a very good regulatory structure. Both APRA and ASIC are highly regarded internationally. Of course, they can improve in some areas, but the fundamental problem isn't with the regulators, it's with the managers of the banks. They're the ones who made the loan decisions, who treated the people poorly, who didn't address conflict of interest issues, who prioritised sales over service. It's the managers of the banks who are ultimately responsible here. So I find it slightly frustrating that the regulators, some people might blame the regulators for ending up in the position that we've ended up in. It's the managers of the banks, and that's where the responsibility needs to lie. Did lax or favourable tax arrangements lead to the housing boom? I don't think that's the fundamental issue. As I said before, population growth picked up and the rate of home building didn't pick up for a decade. Surprise, house prices went up. And when house prices go up, investors think, well, this is a fantastic thing to do, to buy a house, and because the prices are going up every year. And the tax arrangements gave investors a bit of extra encouragement to do that. So my assessment is that the tax arrangements added to the amplification, but the underlying thing, the underlying issue was really the lack of supply response to faster population growth. And not surprisingly, when the supply response took place and accumulated over a few years, prices come down. And the tax arrangements, which are generous, did lead to amplification of it, but it's not the fundamental issue. It's a lack of flexibility on the supply side in response to changes in population dynamics. Because it's not surprising to me that the price increases have been concentrated in Sydney and Melbourne. That's where the population growth moved up a lot. That's where the supply constraints are largest. If you look in our other cities, there have been movements, but they haven't been of the same magnitude, despite the same tax arrangements, despite the same interest rates. What's different about Sydney and Melbourne are the population dynamics and the inflexibility on the supply side of housing. That's the fundamental issue.
Jessica Irvine.
Hi, Phil. I've got 2 points of clarification on things that you've said. First, on mortgage broker commissions, you've said you agree that trailing commissions should go. That leaves upfront commissions, which are charged as a percentage of the loan size, which gives brokers an incentive to maximise what they're getting people to borrow. Do you think that that should be a flat fee rather than a percentage of the loan? And secondly, on the language about forward guidance for monetary policy, I sense a shift, if I'm not wrong, from the next move in interest rates being likely to be up to there's a scenario where it goes up, there's a scenario where it goes down, and that balance is more evenly balanced. Does that mean that interest rates are as likely to go up as they are to go down from here, i.e. it's a coin toss, and the previous language used to describe that has been it's as likely to be up as down? Is that what you mean, or it's more evenly balanced in that? It's not quite 50-50, but it's not as more likely as it was before.
Well, on a flat fee, I don't know enough about kind of the market dynamics to know whether that's going to be better or worse than a kind of a fee based on the value of the loan. I think that's worth looking at in terms of context of who's actually going to pay. Is it the borrower or the lender that pays? That's the more important issue, and it's worth taking the time to get that right, and whether it's a flat fee can be looked at as part of that set of issues. Is it a coin toss? I would never describe it that way, because that gives the sense that it's kind of like completely random. There are two scenarios, basically, and they seem roughly equally likely to me. Whether it's 50-50 or 55-45, I don't want to comment on that because our crystal ball isn't clear enough to know that. But as you said, through much of last year, it looked likely to me that the next move in interest rates would be up than down. I think things today are much more evenly balanced. Whether they're exactly evenly balanced, I'm not sure. Our crystal ball isn't clear enough, but they seem broadly evenly balanced, and it's still entirely plausible that the next move will be up. The labour market's strong, hopefully people's incomes start rising, inflation will rise, and it will be appropriate to raise interest rates. But it's also possible that income growth doesn't pick up, the labour market deteriorates, the housing market weighs on spending in our biggest capital cities, and business confidence declines and they don't want to invest. So that's possible as well. How you assign the probabilities exactly is difficult, but it's a broadly equal.
Michael Yander.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Yander from ABC News. Following on from that, you've emphasised the importance of employment growth for your base case economic outlook. With infrastructure investment near its peak, certainly not growing much from here, with consumption spending slowing from the household sector, where exactly do you see the continued extra jobs growth coming from to continue lowering the unemployment rate and hopefully leading to wage increases?
I mean, you're right, the level of infrastructure investment's high. It's expected to rise a bit further from here, not as quickly as it has, but to rise a bit further. And private business investment's expected to increase. We kind of tend to forget, but before Christmas, the latest capital expenditure survey by the ABS showed firms are planning to increase their capital spending. And we certainly hear that in our liaison program when we talk to businesses. They're operating at a higher level of capacity than they have for quite some time, and they actually want to invest. Interest rates are low. Largely, banks are prepared to lend to businesses, and capacity is tight, so they're prepared to invest, and that creates jobs. I think the other thing that gives me quite a lot of confidence is when we ask, when the ABS asks firms about how many vacancies they currently have, it's at a record high as a share of the labour force, a record high. So there are a lot of job vacancies out there. Firms are operating at high levels of capacity utilisation. They need to invest. The exchange rate's low. Interest rates are low, and it's a good time to invest. So I think that will give the labour market sufficient strength to generate higher income growth and offset the declining housing prices. But there are other scenarios as well, so you can't rule those other scenarios out.
Emily Stewart.
Dr. Lowe, do you think Commissioner Haynes should have gone further and recommended structural changes in the banking industry to ensure that we don't have to have another banking industry Royal Commission in the years to come?
I'm not going to criticise the Royal Commissioner. I think what we needed here was fairly far-reaching reform, not revolution. And that's exactly what we've got, far-reaching reform. I don't think we needed to revise the Twin Peaks model. I think that works quite well. I don't think we needed forced structural separation. I didn't think we needed a kind of a new superannuation regulator. So I think the regulatory structure, leaving that broadly untouched, was the right thing to do. But we did need far-reaching reform, and particularly in the kind of the way that the banks operate and deal with the issues I talked about before, conflicts of interest, service and sales, and we need accountability when things go wrong. And the Royal Commissioner's report has pointed us how to do that, and now it's up to both the banks, the government and the regulators to implement it. And I think the path we're on is a reasonable one.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Everybody, please join me in thanking the Governor Philip Lowe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.